and welcome to Hospice Insights, The Lawn Beyond, where we connect you to what matters in the ever-changing world of hospice and palliative care.
But am I set up for growth? Corporate and governance considerations for growing hospices. Hey, Adam.
Hey, Meg.
I've been bugging you to do this podcast for a while, so thank you for taking me up on it.
Happy to be back on it.
It has been, and you've been busy with all the things that we're talking about in today's session. And I guess just maybe I start out by sort of recapping what we're seeing or what we see a lot across the country. And this applies to nonprofits and for-profits, but I think probably especially nonprofits and how they are organized from a corporate perspective. So 40 some years ago, people started a hospice organization, typically an Inc., and then that's it. And then 40 years have gone by, other than, you know, personnel changes and board changes, nothing else has really changed. And I think that we're at this point in time right now where people are thinking about service expansion and geographic expansion and affiliating with other providers and doing a lot of cool stuff. I think part and parcel with that exploration, you need to think about, is my corporate structure, is the single legal entity now doing 10 things, is that really the right way that sort of best meets the goals? So that's what we're going to talk about today, because, okay, spoiler alert, no, it doesn't. And, you know, lawyers can be wishy-washy, but I really don't think there's few people that I think that makes a lot of sense for. So what are we seeing people do that does make sense? And want to explore that with you today. And maybe let's get out of the way, and hopefully people won't, you know, it will encourage them to continue listening. We are not encouraging you to make complexity for complexity's sake. And I actually think what we're talking about in the session doesn't need to lead to lots of administrative burden and like, oh my God, I'm going to need, you know, someone to just manage all of my boards and all I'm going to be doing is going to board meetings and, you know, all this stuff. I don't think it needs to be that way. So let's just get that sort of misnomer out of place right now, because I don't think that it needs to be that way. And I actually think it can streamline a lot of things for folks. So.
Yep, exactly. And so to your point, what we're generally seeing is for hospices that are either diversifying their service lines and creating new service lines, whether that be expanding into home health or non-hospice palliative care or creating physician practice groups, doing that or growing through acquisitions or by affiliating with other hospices or providers. Generally, what we're seeing is the creation of different entities for different service lines, and then creating a non-operational parent to be the parent entity or holding company for all of those operational entities that are either providing services in different service lines or are acquired entities. The ones actually providing the care. And to the point you just made about complexity, certainly if you have multiple entities, that's going to be a bit more complex than one single entity. It adds something, and you can't get around that. But like you were saying, with a smart governance structure and thinking through kind of how you can link these separate entities together, you can wind up with a pretty sensible, pretty straightforward structure that's easy to operate and maintain, and then has added benefits. So it continues to help growth, and it helps isolate liabilities among and between different service lines and different entities. And that's a key consideration as hospices start to grow. Different service lines will have different risk profiles. And so isolating those from the other providers is crucial.
Well, and I think that in the for-profit world, we're used to creating LLCs, and so nonprofits, not as much, and everything needs to be in ink. So even if you have multiple entities, we run into organizations that have lots and lots of inks. And it's like, well, but for it to be, you know, not, you know, be exempt, it needs to be its own 501c3. And so I think really important for listeners to hear about the whole disregarded LLC. So what oftentimes, and again, this is generalities we're talking about here, but oftentimes this is going to be available to folks where you don't necessarily need, if you want to do home health or whatever in some separate legal entity, you're not going to have to do it as an Inc. Tell us what a disregarded LLC is and how that plays into the big picture for nonprofits in particular.
Yeah. So this is something that's available to both for-profit and non-for-profit entities. And a disregarded entity is an IRS concept that applies to what's called a single member LLC. And so LLCs don't have shareholders, they have members, but it's generally speaking the same concept. The entity or individual that owns that LLC. So if you take a nonprofit corporation, for example, that exists today as one entity, that corporation creates an LLC that the corporation owns, and the corporation is the sole member of that LLC, then from a federal tax perspective, that LLC is what's called a disregarded entity, meaning that it would, in this instance, share the tax-exempt status of the parent, so the nonprofit corporation. It would be treated as that corporation. The LLC wouldn't have to file a separate tax return. So all of the LLC's profits and losses would be rolled up to the parent and reported on the parent's 990. The same thing applies with a for-profit corporation, but it would be that corporation's tax returns, not a 990. But that's the gist. And it's a benefit.
And maybe just to talk about that for listeners who aren't super familiar with LLCs, and you say it's a member managed or manager managed, there's a choice there. But essentially, in a non-corporate way of speaking here, it's not like you have to have full board for that LLC. So when we talk about streamlining governance, it means, translate that for me. What does it mean? What's the minimum you need to have? Because your big board's probably still going to be on top, right? All those members that have, you know, board members that have always been there. Who needs to be on this organization's leadership?
Yeah, we like LLCs because there's a lot more flexibility in how they're managed. With a corporation, you essentially have to have a board. With an LLC, you don't have to have a board. The LLCs can either be member managed or manager managed. And that simply means if they're member managed, whoever the member is in charge of making decisions and binding the LLC. If they're manager managed, that means you appoint an individual or an entity to act as the manager, and then the members delegate that manager some authority to operate the LLC, oversee the LLC, and bind the LLC. And then kind of between those two, there are different iterations of how you set that up. But those are the two basic options that states tend to recognize. And so in practice, if you have this sort of simplified structure where it's a nonprofit corporation owning the LLC, you can make the LLC member managed, which means it's managed by the Inc., which in turn is governed by the board. And so the board of that corporation is ultimately the one making decisions both for the corporation and the LLC.
Yeah. And I think that's super helpful because I do think a lot of our corporate clients, they're very familiar with the governance of INCs and less familiar with LLCs and sort of the flexibility there, which is, I think, super important. And the time to think about this stuff is now, or like before you do stuff, because, you know, we're working where we worked on projects where, you know, they do have multiple entities under their corporate umbrella, but a lot of them are inks. The parent is an operational entity, and it's not like you can't legally convert an ink to an LLC, but it's a lot of work, right? So it's better to, if you're thinking of these expansion opportunities, growth opportunities, best to sort of get that in place before you start pursuing these things, because then you're really in a plug and play mode as opposed to, like, you know, trying to recreate the past, because it's harder to do it and obviously more expensive. And it's probably, you know, is it really worth the squeeze at that point?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But generally what we found is the LLCs, you know, if you're in a position where you're creating a new entity as opposed to dealing with currently existing entities and how those can fit in your organizational structure, the LLC does tend to make a lot of sense for all of those reasons. And you get the same asset protection as you do in a corporation, just without the headache of a separate board.
So let's unpack a bit the non-operational parent or holding company. And we use the non-operational parent as sort of shorthand because this entity isn't going to hold any licenses as a healthcare provider or anything like that. And I would say one common question we get when we're working through this with clients is to say, well, I'll just put my parent company, you know, why doesn't my big entity just become the parent? And that holds a bunch of hospice licenses and real estate and all this stuff. And it's like, no.
Yeah.
Not probably the best. And so, in brief, why is that not the best, ideally?
Yeah, it really boils down to risk and isolating liabilities among entities. If you have an existing entity that's operating your hospice, that hospice operation creates a fairly large risk profile. I mean, even if you look just at audit liabilities alone, we're seeing pretty extensive liabilities potentially just from CMS audits alone. And so those are all liabilities that a hospice could face through the ordinary course of its hospice operations. And so generally, when you're looking at how CMS would treat those liabilities. CMS will initially look to the PTAN that is audited, but then can and will extend that liability to other PTANs owned by the same EIN, so the same tax ID. So if you have an entity with multiple PTANs, that liability could be shared among multiple PTANs. On the other hand, if you have separate entities that have different EINs, generally speaking, the liability stays with the EIN. It won't transfer to another EIN. So being able to separate out your hospice, home health, and any other kind of providers into their own EINs, and then put a non-operational parent on top helps isolate that risk. And then from a general corporate perspective, if you have an operational parent, so meaning one that operates a provider and has a PTAN, could potentially be faced with these liabilities. If that provider or that entity owns other entities, those liabilities could be shared by the entities that it owns as assets of that entity. So creditors, whether that be CMS or any other creditors, could potentially satisfy a liability from the assets of a subsidiary. So the liability of a parent being satisfied from the assets of a subsidiary, not conversely, though.
Yeah. So things can flow down, but not up. And so I think that that's sort of misnomer number two. So one is like, oh, this is going to require lots of boards and governance and all this stuff. And then second is like, well, I just pop these entities under my big entity that holds all this stuff. And it's like, well, you probably ideally want to do something more wholesale. And there's so much we could talk about here, but I think maybe the last place we go is that to do this kind of stuff that we're talking about, it is going to require reporting to CMS through the 855 and, you know, to state licensing and whatnot. But that's just sort of pause on that and be like, that's not the end of the world. Like these are, I feel like there are folks I've talked to and it's like, I don't want to do anything that requires updating. It's like, given how frequently you need to be updating your 855, like anytime there's a board change or, you know, high level manager change, you need to be updating. These are like routine things. So it's not a big deal, especially if it's a change of information. So if in short, the tax ID isn't changing of the entity, you know, so you just put a new operational parent on top, you know, that might not, you know, it might just be a change of information and not what we call a change of ownership. Again, it sort of depends on if you're having to move around where the provider number is held and whatnot. But it's not, these things aren't insurmountable. And I just think that hospices are getting to be larger and larger and more complex and more sophisticated organizations. And we really need to have corporate hygiene and sophistication that matches that, because it's as you said, like hospices, just from a government liability standpoint, with audits and stuff, there is a lot of liability. We might not have the same malpractice liability that like an OBGYN is going to have, but you know, I mean, pick your poison, right? I mean, there's, you know, we deal with $100 million overpayments that would bankrupt any company. I mean, it doesn't matter how big you are. So, this stuff is real. And so I think thinking through this and, I think can make a lot of sense. And sometimes I think we're dealing with this in two different situations. Some people are planning for growth and change, and so they're doing it sort of proactively. Other times we're working on these projects, like we're working on an affiliation, and then, you know, it makes sense to do think through the sort of structuring at the same time about what makes, you know, exploring these questions and stuff and thinking through that governance piece. But I think they've been really worthwhile projects because we've been doing a lot of these. And in terms of, is it worth the squeeze? I think absolutely, given that I don't think we're going back to the future. Like, we're not going back to hospices that are, you know, really small, you know, volunteer-based organizations. I mean, we're, you know, many million-dollar organizations, typically 10, 100 million, several hundred million-dollar organizations. And the things we're talking about is consistent with, like, what the larger corporate world and corporate healthcare world really does. And one thing we didn't talk about a ton, but maybe just worth a mention, is also how you hold your real estate, which is a huge asset, like putting that all in an LLC instead of holding that at the, you know, operational, you know, entity level and stuff like that. So I think we may be getting more rich in real estate as an industry. And so, you know, that's another thing to think about here.
Yeah, the real estate could be the hospice's biggest or one of their biggest assets. So putting that in its own LLC, again, to isolate it from any liabilities that could be shared from any of the operational entities, is a smart thing to do, and a good way to protect that asset. And again, it's something routinely done in other types of healthcare organizations and just non-healthcare organizations. So it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And I guess the final point, I'll give myself the final word here. I feel like it's so, I always have so many thoughts floating in my head. I'm worried I'm going to forget them. But I guess the last thing I wanted to share was there are some hospice regulatory nuance here, like core services requirements, and how do you meet those when you do this? And then, you know, the governing body requirement under the hospice regulatory framework, who's the governing body? Those are all things we've worked through. I don't want to get into that granular detail here, but a lot of this stuff's corporate stuff, but there is this hospice nuancey stuff is really unique to what we're doing that are not really matched by, you know, your average corporate lawyer isn't going to know about that stuff. And so we also need to be making sure, you know, when surveyors come around, like, we can show we're meeting these requirements. And so, you know, when we work with clients talking through how to comply with that aspect, because they're very important things to think about as we do this, and they shouldn't be an afterthought. But anyway, well, this has been, we've been doing a lot of this, and it's been fun work. And I think fun to feel like we're putting our clients in the best possible shape to grow and thrive into the future. And so I think it's been rewarding work.
It has. Yeah. Getting to see how it fits with their strategies and growth plans is always interesting and rewarding to be a part of.
And if you're doing proactive work instead of reactive all the time, that's also sort of
not a panic.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, well, thanks so much for your time and wisdom on this, Adam. You've been so critical to our team and leading our team on, you know, these things, because you know tons of stuff I don't know, because you came to this work in a different way than I did. And so it takes all of us, right? It takes the village here.
It does. Yep. And thanks for having me back on the podcast. It's good to be back on.
Great. Thank you.
that's it for today's episode of Hospice Insights, The Law and Beyond. Thank you for joining the conversation. To subscribe to our podcast, visit our website at hushblackwell.com or sign up wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, may the wind be at your back.